Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Han, and as much as we like to talk about Brexit as a generation-defining issue, climate change probably takes the cake when it comes to sheer life or death importance and urgency. For today's show, we are joined by Richard McCrory, who was the UK's first professor of environmental law and who is the co-chair of the UK Environmental Law Association Brexit Task Force, which is a bit of a mouthful. But moving right along, welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you.
Currently, there are about 80% of UK environmental rules that are shaped in Brussels. Can you give us a few examples of the main things that the EU has done for environmental protection in the UK?
Yeah, I think from a lawyer's perspective, I think there are three main things. The first thing it's done is to introduce very precise standards for things like air quality or water quality into the law. That didn't really happen before. It was all left to rather government discretion. We had legal frameworks, but they weren't very precise. Secondly, in certain areas such as waste, we have very clear targets for recycling or for reducing landfill, again, which has been written into the legislation, not something we really did in the UK. And then lastly, I think that the EU has developed what are called five-year action programs, where about every 5 years, the EU and the member states try and lay out their program for the next 5 years, the priorities and so on. And again, that's a very useful document to give some stability, helps industry, it helps the public to understand where things are going. And again, it's not something we've really done in the UK, and I think that's been helpful.
So how do you see that being affected by Brexit? Do you think these are things that are going to be taken over into the UK? Well, are they going to change?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the big challenge, because the government policy at the moment, which I think is a sensible policy, is that we will roll over existing EU environmental law as far as possible. So we will preserve these air quality standards. We will have these targets in our law, and that's to preserve regulatory stability. But at some point, which might be in 4 or 5 years' time, government will review all that and decide, do they want to continue this tradition or not? And I think that's when the really interesting debates will happen. You know, I'm not completely confident that some of those attributes of EU environmental law and policy up to now, you know, will get preserved in the debates that come. And that's what we are looking at very closely.
So what are the parts of it that you are worried won't be preserved?
Well, I think, you know, let me give you a very good example, because there's been a lot of litigation about it. Air quality standards, where there are air quality standards in EU law, and unusually they are completely unqualified. They simply say that the Secretary of State in all the EU countries must achieve this air quality by this particular date. Generally, what we have done in UK law in similar things is to say something like, the Secretary of State shall, as far as practicable or without undue cost, achieve these goals. So there's a lot of wiggle room to get out of that. And if I was government, I would try and revise these standards. So to, if you like, put in the qualifications, if I could. Now, in air quality, because it's such a political issue at the moment, it may be that they would not be able to do that. But there will be other examples where they will, from a lawyer's point of view, they'll try and soften the legal obligations, which up to now have been in the EU law.
And then what practical consequences do you see that having?
Well, I think this is one example where, for instance, just simply holding a government or another public body to legal account will be more difficult if that happens. I mean, we've had the example this year and last year of the client earth air pollution cases in the court. And one of the reasons that they've been successful to date in legal terms is that the EU law, and then it's transposed into UK law, is very precise and unqualified. Now, once you start changing that, then it's much more difficult to enforce the law. And there are other major questions about enforcement, I think, which are going to become much more important in the next couple of years as we talk about Brexit. And one of the issues is that at the moment, the European Commission one of its roles is to monitor how member states comply with the legal obligations they've agreed to. Do they implement these directives? Do they not? And the Commission has a number of lawyers who pick up cases. They get alerted by the public if the public feel there is a problem, and they investigate. And a lot of the cases they're able to negotiate out and deal with member states and come to a solution. But at the end of the day, they can go off to the European Court of Justice. And indeed, the European Court even has the power to fine a member state who consistently doesn't comply with the law. So it's quite a powerful legal remedy. And the vast majority of cases in Europe actually are concerned with the environment. Now, all that will disappear after Brexit. The Commission won't have a role in monitoring how the UK complies with its obligations. There won't be a citizens' complaint procedure, and so on. And at the moment, the government has said, well, we've still got judicial review. NGOs can bring their own actions to hold government to account. And our view at UKLA, as practicing environmental lawyers, is that judicial review is fine as a long stop, but it's a very expensive process. It's very difficult to kind of settle JRs, you know, in a sensible way. Once you get into a JR, it tends to get to court, and it's a very kind of black-white issue. And we are proposing that we do need some new, after Brexit, some new body, some sort of environmental ombudsman or a parliamentary commissioner for the environment, which will help hold government and public bodies to account. That's the gap that's going to happen after Brexit.
So what do you see that monitoring body looking like? And what do you think of it being set up?
Sure. We've just published a report on this, and although we haven't sort of deliberately plumped for a particular model, because I don't think, you know, one has to do a lot more investigation, there are various examples around the world. There are examples of environmental ombudsmen. There's a very interesting model in New Zealand called the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment. And this is a body, I think it's about 20 people, funded by Parliament, actually, and which investigates either complaints or particular problems which government is having, and then makes reports to Parliament on this. And I think that that's the sort of model I think will be needed, because I think the environment is in a particular strange position, because in most areas of law, if you think of competition law, or intellectual property, or perhaps workers' rights, there are very clear legal interests who will protect themselves, you know, be it a company or a trade union or whatever, will make sure their legal rights are enforced. The problem with the environment is there is often no direct legal interest in it. And as somebody once said, you know, the environment dies in silence. And unless you have lots of NGOs, but, you know, it's not right to completely depend on NGOs to do this, or some more interesting public body to actually help monitor this, then I think we've potentially got a bad situation on that.
Now, you are a co-chair, as I mentioned earlier, of the UK Environmental Law Association Brexit Task Force. Can you run me a bit through, first of all, what the association itself is and what you do, and then what you do within the task force?
Okay. Well, the UK Environmental Law Association was founded over 30 years ago. It's about 1,200 lawyers, both practitioners, lawyers who work in the public sector, some academic lawyers, and indeed non-lawyers, people like consultants who have a lot of contact with environmental law. So it's a membership organization as such. It's not really an NGO. It doesn't take judicial reviews, but it wants to both train and publish reports and so on. On Brexit, UKLA, I think sensibly, had a neutral stance. It wasn't either pro or anti, but it said basically, and that's still the underlying principle, whatever is the result, we don't want to see our existing environmental law jeopardized, and indeed we want to look for opportunities to improve it. So that's the sort of basic starting point. We then earlier this year set up a Brexit task force, about 27 people, again a mixture of some judges and practicing lawyers and so on. We've got a very small research staff, and myself and a colleague are co-chairing this task force. And really what we had to do and what we are doing now is to, first of all, identify where can UKLA make a distinctive difference. We can't do everything. You know, we haven't got the resources to do everything. But where can we publish a report? Where can we talk to people and make a difference? And I think one of the what we can do is that we are considered to have some authority. We're quite independent, and as I said, we're not political in with a large P. We are a little bit detached, but can just simply say, if you do it this way, it's not likely to work. There are some real problem areas, and you've got to do that. So we are now in the process. We have about 6 reports coming out, which we will publish, give to parliamentarians, the government, and so on. And I think hopefully it assists the debates and the challenges that are going to come in the next few years.
When it comes to funding for environmental issues in the UK, do we sort of pay more into the EU than we get back? How much of our funding here?
Right. It's always incredibly difficult to work out those sort of costings and whether overall the contribution we make comes out. I mean, in my field, for instance, in environmental law, there has been a lot of grants from the EU, I think about 10 million a year for work on sort of environmental law, habitats, nature conservation, which comes to the UK, the 10 million a year in various sorts of projects. And of course, agriculture has enormous amounts of money going through it. Now, I think the government policy at the moment, certainly with agriculture and certainly for the time being, is that whatever sums are going to agriculture now will continue to go to agriculture, but from the UK pot. It's going to get more difficult, I think, with some of these more specialised funds, which often play an extremely useful part. I mean, for instance, give you one example, and where the UK often contributes to the EU in terms of policy initiatives and so on. It's not a sort of one-way street, always imposing on us. We have ideas. We are, I think, very good, and we're very interested in enforcement, and helped initiate through our Environment Agency setting up a network of European prosecutors in the environment, people who actually take cases to court, who are often quite isolated in their own countries. And so this was a kind of network. Well, that was some core funding for that came from the EU to help get that going and set that up. Now, what will happen, first of all, to the UK side of it after Brexit? Do we still stay a member in some way or observer states? We have no idea yet. And also, would there be similar funding initiatives within the UK post-Brexit? I think it will be more difficult for those sort of rather specialised projects, not very large sums of money, but where, you know, a grant of 100,000 ECUs or 200,000 can make all the difference to get some project off the ground.
So Michael Gove has pledged that the UK's wildlife laws will increase post-Brexit and that he's talking to environmental groups. Are you quite hopeful about the way that the government's handling this far?
Well, I any lawyer will say this, the devil will be in the detail. I think Mr. Gove, I don't know him personally, and I'm sure you saw, he gave a very interesting speech some weeks ago, which was, as far as I can see, was clearly written by him, was personally engaged and intellectually engaged with the issue. And on the surface, you know, he said, don't worry, we're going to have better times for the environment, and the environment is going to be at the centre of our policies. The problem is that, he won't be the only person. There are other forces at work, other government departments who probably don't see it quite that way. And I've yet to hear, I think, for instance, the Prime Minister to give a major speech about the environment and what she actually thinks about that. But I do think it's very interesting. I think Mr. Gove wants to make a mark on this. And as you indicated, he is certainly talking assiduously to the NGOs, to other groups and so on, to really try to understand what the challenges are. And I think we haven't had a kind of heavyweight in the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, you know, for a number of years. So from my perspective, you know, I try and be an optimist. So I say that must be a good thing.
As we were just talking about the Prime Minister and her attitudes towards the environment, one of her first actions in office was to abolish the Department for Energy and Climate Change and move its responsibilities to a new department entitled the Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Department. Yeah. Do you think this is concerning, and what do you think that says about how she feels about the environment?
Well, again, I'm not an expert in the organisation of government departments, and I've heard two stories about this. One, that it's symbolically looked like climate change was being downgraded, having had its own separate department. But there is another story to say that, you know, the real challenges of climate change are going to be in completely changing the way we think about energy and energy delivery and energy services, structure of industry in that sense. And actually, to put it within the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy is actually is a productive way. So it's not really a downgrading. It's you know, and at the end of the day, it would all depend on ministers within those departments, the priority it gives. Climate change is particularly interesting from a lawyer's point of view because the UK has this Climate Change Act, which is sort of ahead of any legislation within the EU, and it sets very clear legally binding targets on government over until 2050, a trajectory. So that is kind of driving, you know, that one can't get away from that. And I think it's very unlikely, particularly with current majorities, that legislation would be repealed. I don't think anybody would try and do that. So I think climate change is a very interesting one. So I'm not as pessimistic about that move that took place in there. And I don't think it was particularly symbolic of a downgrading. It was just saying, you know, on the other side is, well, can we deliver better by embedding this within an existing department? Because otherwise, you know, a department with just one sort of is actually isolated from those departments which create the delivery of it, if that makes sense.
I found this quite interesting because in a way it's sort of, obviously not completely, but slightly a mirror to how I think Donald Trump sees climate change. Yes. That's a very, very bold statement, and I don't mean that completely in the sense that obviously Theresa May didn't withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement or anything as drastic as that, but he certainly did that sort of in the name of restoring jobs for the coal industry. So that sort of grouping of industry and environment together, I sort of see there in both places. And to me personally, I find that a bit concerning because I feel like it can prevent real progress from being made because obviously, yes, industry includes people who, for example, use solar energy, but it also obviously includes coal and oil and things like that. So I'm worried that that being grouped in sort of the same group together could have an adverse effect.
Yeah, absolutely. We could have a debate on that. I mean, I certainly, my own view is that the delivery of serious climate change policies and the outcomes, you know, it's going to be vital to get industry, you know, on board, and they will provide a lot of solutions to that. I mean, I've been very involved in something called carbon capture technology, which is basically, you know, capturing the CO2 from gas or coal, where again, industry, people like Bishop Petroleum and people like that were taking a lead on this as a future technology. But actually government screwed it all up with all the financing in this country. We've had sort of problems in that. So it's a kind of, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I don't share that we are going down the Trump route to and the view of climate change. I don't get any indication that from the government. I think they're completely committed to the Paris Agreement. And I'd say that Britain, you know, one of the things, if you look, you know, we some of our environment stuff has a very negative image in Europe, and we're thought to hold things back. I think climate change is one area where for the last 8 or 9 years, we've actually been quite a force for good, you know, pushing the targets and pushing the obligations and so on. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are on that. I mean, I'll get pessimistic when, you know, we see things equivalent to the EPA in the States, the Environmental Protection Agency, where we see, you know, our own environment agency or naturally, I mean, singled out for being cut back, not just everybody suffering austerity, but or appointments made, which are clearly people who have not got the environment in their interests. But again, I haven't got any evidence for that at the moment, and I don't feel that's a real strong thing. And I think you'll find, and I think you've already seen that in the States, that in fact, yes, there are some industries, and perhaps the coal industry is one, and some of the oil industry who are, you know, going to persist in trying to denigrate climate change policies and so on. But there are whole sectors of industry, as you've indicated, and I think not just, you know, the ones directly who are going to get the benefits of renewable energies and so on, but lots of industries, sort of some in the middle, who do say, do see that, you know, we're going to have to change quite a lot and we're going to have to adapt and all of that. And they want to be at the forefront of this. I mean, it's the same argument which I often have with government about regulation. And normally, when, you know, when I talk to the waste disposal industry or other industries, you know, they don't mind regulation. They actually quite like regulation because it squeezes out the cowboys. They can comply with it. What they want is clarity in what the regulatory requirements are, time to adapt, and also, and this is an area which I have a great interest in, they want to see it properly enforced. You know, the one thing they hate is where I'm complying with the regulation, but my competitor down the road isn't, and nobody's enforcing it. But I don't think generally industry does, it's scared of regulation. And this is something, you know, we've had in governments of all shades for the last 15 years. It's a very kind of anti-regulation thing. And I don't think actually that's necessarily reflected in industry. And I hope that as we reevaluate where we're going on environmental policy, that the importance of regulation is accepted and people understand that.
Well, I definitely do think we need somewhere of that optimism. So what do you think can be the opportunities from Brexit in terms of environmental policy?
Well, I think we could get much more clearly drafted legislation. I mean, there are, you know, not all EU environmental law is perfect. What I should say is it's, I think mostly it's been beneficial for both the UK and certainly for the EU as a whole, because I don't think individually the member states would have achieved as much as they did collectively. But, you know, you look at areas such as waste law, and it's incredibly complex, and the drafting is very bad, and it creates a lot of difficulties for anybody trying to comply with it. So I certainly think there are opportunities there where we could make the law a lot clearer. I think there are also, as we were discussing earlier, I think it's created an opportunity or a space to really think about our institutional structures and, you know, do we need a fresh body now that we won't have the European Commission? Do we need a new body to really hold government and other public bodies to account? And I think actually, strangely, without Brexit, that wouldn't have happened. So those sorts of things are very interesting. I think the other big dynamic you're going to get is with the devolved administrations, because I think one of the effects of Brexit, assuming, you know, it's a pretty real Brexit, is that the devolved administrations, particularly Scotland and Wales, will have more power in the environment because they're not constrained by EU laws as such. And actually, they will make initiatives. I mean, we've seen that in certain areas, just as Wales with plastic bag tax, where, you know, the then UK government or British government saying, we can't do this, you know, it'll be disastrous. Wales goes ahead with it, and actually, you know, everybody seems to gain and the public like it. And then we get a UK-wide thing. So that's a very good example where by allowing initiatives in devolved regions, then that could be picked up. And I know, for instance, you know, Scotland and Wales at the moment, the governments, you know, are looking at this question about enforcement and should we create some new types of bodies and so on. So that, again, that's a side which the opportunities are there to create something. I think the other challenge on the other side is that I am very keen, and we are about to publish a report about this, is that the whole range of European environmental bodies, such as the European Environment Agency in Copenhagen, where I think the UK, it would be very useful for the UK to stay a part of those bodies. You know, they don't have legal powers and so on, but you need to find out what is going on in other countries, exchange best practice, have initiatives, because I think we are, you know, environmentally, we are still part of Europe, whatever happens after Brexit. So we need to do this. And we're just about to publish a list of, I think it's about 25 European bodies, from judicial cooperation prosecutors, I've mentioned it to this in Europe, and Environment Agency and so on, and trying to analyse, I think, these ones we should stay a part of. And I really hope the government will pick that lesson up.
Yeah, and we won't just be a part of Europe, I suppose. We'll obviously be part of the world, which is...
Absolutely.
...as a whole, obviously affected by climate change, without a question. Yeah. And then I'm assuming international environmental law will still have a massive impact on what can be done in the country here.
Absolutely. Well, it's a very important area. I think the UK has ratified about 40 international environmental treaties. Some of them very detailed, some of them very important, climate change and Paris Agreement and so on. Again, we're about to publish quite a big report where we've analysed all these treaties. And one of the complications with Brexit is that some of the treaties we've just signed on our own, and that's fine, they continue. But other ones, the EU signed it, if you like, on behalf of all member states, areas such as fisheries. And the question is, what happens after Brexit? You know, do they fall by the wayside? And then there are other ones which are called mixed agreements, where we've both signed, both the EU and all the member states, because the competences, it crosses national and EU competences. And the legal position there is a bit more uncertain about what actually happens after Brexit. I think the government's intention is that we should continue to be bound by them all, but that's not necessarily going to happen unless we, you know, really look at it closely. And I'd say the other thing is that although international law, environmental law is, you know, it's a positive thing, the enforcement of international environmental law is not nearly so good. I mean, it still relies largely on peer pressure. And compared to the enforcement in the EU, the procedures I've already mentioned, there's nothing really like that at international level. So although it's important, we shouldn't completely rely on that. But I think one of the, you know, and this is pure speculation, but, what I would hope after Brexit is that in the environmental field, we still have a very positive relationship with the EU. Part of the exit agreement may well be that, you know, we have to continue to comply with a lot of standards at EU level and so on. So we'll be part of that. But then we are also the UK, you know, we're part of this very interesting body, the Commonwealth, which has this extraordinary collection of countries from countries in Africa, developing countries, India, Australia, Canada, not the US. And I see, you know, part of my vision is that, okay, we should now make the opportunity to really develop this in the environmental field and the climate, field of climate change, because it's a completely distinctive and unusual body, which sort of shares a sort of common legal tradition and history, obviously. But in the context of something like climate change, you know, to have those connections with all those different types of countries, I think could be an amazing opportunity. And we've never really sort of capitalized on that. So maybe that's going to be... So I want us to be looking EU and the Commonwealth and then the world, as you say.
Well, that is an aim. Before I let you go, I want to ask just a couple questions more generally about climate change and how you think the average person interacts with it. Do you think the average Joe fully grasps the possible consequences of climate change and the urgency of it?
It's very difficult to tell. I think probably not, although you may get, if you look at different age ranges, partly because, you know, it is incredibly difficult to really pin down, you know, the effects we're seeing now, you know, flooding in America and so on. You know, if you've got 20 scientists together and say, is it climate change that's causing that? They would say, well, it's consistent with the models, but we can't actually tell you. Whereas if you take something like air pollution in London, you know, we can tell now that we know the sources, we know the causes of it, whether we can politically deal with it. So the public will get much more concerned. So I think that is a problem with climate change, that it's politically. I mean, my view on climate change is that we have the technology to handle it. You know, we've got the technology to deal with it, but we have to get the real political will. And the political will, which is really what you've indicated when you talk about Joe Public, but you know, politicians are elected and they need the signals from the public. To do that, or you know, be aware that if they make uncomfortable decisions, the public may not like that. And so that is a real challenge. I'm not going to say that's easy. And in a way, one of my colleagues talks about, you know, the easy environmental issues and the difficult ones. And the easy ones were the sort of little things I was dealing with earlier in my career, like waste disposal, radioactive waste, water pollution, air pollution. Where in a sense, you know, the cause and effect are very clear, the science is very clear, the solutions are pretty clear, even the law is quite clear what you need to do. And actually, there are more winners than losers. You know, if you introduce tough air pollution controls, okay, the vehicle manufacturers will have a tough time. Some members of the public won't be able to drive in London, but basically more people will win than lose. And that politically is very attractive. If you think of something like climate change, you know, there are still uncertainties in the science, as we know. We don't really know what sort of laws we need. You know, what are we talking about? And also, although in the long run we hope we're all going to be winners, you know, everybody's going to suffer a bit. You know, if you think, and I'm as guilty as anybody, you know, I certainly take more flights than I used to, perhaps even 15 years ago. You know, I try and do offsetting, but I'm not sure if that really helps. But, you know, if a government introduces a law saying you can only fly a maximum of 5,000 miles a year, you know, they would not get voted in at the next election. And that's a real issue, actually, you have to sort of recognise that. So that's why, you know, a lot of my faith is pinned in how we deliver energy to houses, how we deliver heating, and so on. And I think there's some big revolutions about to take place. Just as you've seen with the, with the electric car, where I think, again, we're on the sort of cusp of the technology. It'll still be 10, 20 years before it really comes into play.
So how optimistic are you about all of that actually happening and actually making a change? I think that's quite a big question. How optimistic are you about climate change being reversed?
I go up and down. I mean, I cut my teeth when I 40 years ago as the in-house lawyer for Friends of the Earth. I just qualified as a lawyer, and it was a very small NGO operating in London, about 12 people, quite a new type of NGO in this country. We had environmental NGOs before, but Friends of the Earth was looking at it quite differently. But I have to say that all the campaigns that we had then was one about bicycling, one about energy, about agriculture, about resources. I sometimes feel the problems, you know, they're still there. There's greater recognition of these problems, but we haven't resolved a lot of them, and that takes a long time. Now, I talk to people about this, and I get depressed, and they say, no, don't get depressed. That's because the issues we identified then, or those groups then, you know, are just issues which are going to be with us for 100 years or 200. These are really important issues. These are not fly-by-night fashionable things. They are fundamental ways that we relate to the world, and therefore, you know, expect them to carry on for some time. So to that extent, I'm vaguely optimistic. I think the difficulty is that, again, compared to a much simpler black-and-white world, you know, 40 years ago, it's a kind of everybody speaks the language now. You know, they'll talk about sustainable development, they'll talk about climate change. And the difficulty is to judge, you know, are they really serious about it? Is it, you know, do they really mean business? You know, and you take something like air quality, which we've talked about, which is an issue. Well, we've had in the books for at least about 20 years, you know, the framework of air quality laws, very good, you know, about air quality plans, local authorities having to survey, introduce measuring. But really, you know, not much has happened because the political will and probably the money wasn't there to do it. So you've got to have these all going in tandem. You know, you can have the most perfect laws, but if the political will isn't there or the money is being pumped in, no good. I would say, as a lawyer, you know, if you don't have proper laws, then you'll find it very difficult to achieve real change. So it's a question of working together. I'm a cautious optimist.
That's always a good thing to be, a cautious optimist. So what can the average person that we just talked about do on sort of a practical, everyday level to contribute, do you think?
Well, I think, there's always been a strong interest generally in the environment in this country. And, you know, there are more members of the Royal South Protection of Birds than all the membership of the political parties. So these are very, you know, they're potentially very strong bodies. I mean, I would say join one of those conservation groups, the one that sort of makes sense to you or you like the look of them. I'm a great believer in sort of trying to work by example. So I have now at last, I persuaded my wife, I bought a second-hand all-electric car. And I'm switched my energy supplier to a renewable energy supplier, and it seems to be slightly cheaper than my conventional one. But what's interesting is that suddenly, you know, the village I live in Oxfordshire, I think it's about the first of these electric cars, and most people, you know, begin with are very cynical, and they said, oh, you'll never get up the hills. And actually, once you show them that these cars, you know, perfect acceleration and the range is perfectly adequate for, you know, not going on long distances at the moment, but for pottering about, you know, fantastic. So I think doing things by example is very important. And then just, you know, pressurizing your, I still believe in democracy, you know, and MPs, writing to your MP if you're concerned about environmental issues and pushing them, because they do take, particularly in the current politics, there's very small majorities and so on, the backbench MPs will have a lot more influence. And backbench MPs do take notice of their postbag and what people write.
And that's all the Brexit news we have for you today. Do check back next week, as always, for any more Brexit news and opinions that you might need. I've been your host, Jennifer Han, here with my co-host, Tim Hemming, who's also my co-producer on the show, along with Warren Paul. Our theme song is brought to you by Kevin MacLeod, and we hope you'll be joining us again soon.